This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 23rd of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, many in the business community make their case for Britain to stay in the European Union, but many others stay silent. Plus, Republicans descend on Nevada as endorsements and insults fly in the lead up to the all-important Super Tuesday. We'll also look at the Italian Prime Minister's rather ambitious plan to turn an old abandoned island prison into an elite international academy. And a little later in the show, Switzerland vows to keep its 1,000 franc note. And which city is best for quality of life? You know our top picks, and it seems we're not alone. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for the Berliner Zeitung, and Mary Jajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to start with a story dominating many of the front pages across Europe today. When London's mayor took a leap into Britain's EU exit campaign yesterday, few doubted the reaction it would arouse from a disapproving prime minister. Today, however, much of the UK's business community made its thoughts known. They want Britain to stay right where it is. Telecommunications company BT, retailer Marks & Spencer, and airline EasyJet are just some of those who signed an open letter published in the Times newspaper. But most telling, perhaps, was what wasn't said. Conspicuously, some of the nation's biggest corporations stayed silent. So are we really any clearer on where business is on this issue? Mary, are we any clearer? And do we care, really? You know, I guess in the end, it still feels to me that for many people, when they come to the decision, and I think many people have already come to the decision, it's more of a gut instinct about what's right and what's wrong. I'm not sure they're going to be listening to these CEOs, but how important do you think this letter was today?
I think it probably isn't. I mean, I think it's probably as much of a sort of bolsterer for Cameron and for the government at the moment, because they suddenly found themselves rather under siege at the weekend just after they'd announced the referendum date. But I think one of the most interesting things, as you pointed out, were the number of big businesses who didn't sign. And what is interesting about that is that you can sort of imagine, many of them are sort of consumer direct retailers, including some of the biggest supermarkets. And you can sort of imagine that buyers themselves and households might run their own little campaigns of sort of boycotts on the internet if they found that their particular supermarket wasn't following their particular line on the referendum. So I think they're probably quite wise to stay out of it.
Well, this is exactly writ large what Boris Johnson, everyone claims, was up to at the weekend, dithering, because, you know, he realizes that for his brand, his personal brand, if he's on the winning or losing side, it could make a big difference. And I think for some of these companies as well, they're a little bit concerned. But Sebastian, when you look at the business field, you know, in the end, you know, it seems most businesses do feel that it would be, especially if there's a business of scale, it would be wise to stay put. And do you think that is how Europe looks at us and thinks, in the end, people will vote with their pocket, with their jobs, with their sense of security, and they will go along with what, you know, what's been offered?
I completely disagree with Mary. I think the letter was important. I think it seems to me completely obvious that any big corporation which is interested in the European market, which is after all the biggest market in the world, consumer market, should do everything it can to stay in that market with unimpeded access, which it won't have if Britain decides to go. Secondly, the fact that some haven't signed, it's neither here nor there. I mean, come on, we've got the biggest energy companies in Britain, if not the world, BP and Royal Dutch Shell. We've got big banks like Credit Suisse, Standard Chartered, HSBC. And some haven't signed. Yes, well, that's I'm not particularly interested in that argument. The fact is, I and gut instinct here or there. Again, I disagree. I think the British people. Well, I hope maybe I'm losing touch with reality. My take on the British people has always been that they have obviously huge arguments and great emotional debates, particularly about Europe. But in the end, they have a pretty good. They've got their head screwed on, as you say. You know, they've got a pretty good business sense, and it simply doesn't make sense for business to leave the European Union.
I agree with you, but do you think this is one of those? This is the interesting fissure, I guess, is, you know, that I think when people sit outside of this debate, or when they look around Britain, they say, okay, yeah, big business and corporations, they make money from this process. You know, even on the question of migration, for example, they are kind of net benefactors because they get, you know, they get a huge supply of labour. It keeps labour costs down. They can pick and choose who they want. But it's the people who are kind of a bit, you know, a bit outside that process, maybe running a smaller business, even just an employee, feel actually this shouldn't be decided on business. And I keep on hearing this point come up again and again, people saying, in the end, I don't mind if I'm a bit poorer,
yeah,
if I feel that I have a sense of community protected and I have some feeling that I'm more in control.
That's what Nigel Farage has said 2 years ago, the leader of the UKIP party. I take your point. I think the interesting thing is that with the letter to the Times from all these business captains today, there was also a letter from Francis O'Grady, the leader of the TUC, the Trade Unions Congress, who made the point that a lot of the workers' protection rights, maternity leave, paternity leave, paid holiday, etc., came in to this country, or at least was put into law through European Union regulations. So this is obviously very important, not to just say, well, the big corporations like it. No, it's also about workers' rights. And don't tell me that people like Nigel Farage and his hedge fund cronies wouldn't do away with all that if they could. I'm completely convinced on that. And can I also say, there are, of course, also business people who are voting for Brexit. I mean, James Dyson is the interesting example, who likes the vacuum cleaner tycoon, who likes to talk about how terrible the European Union is, dominated by German interests and therefore very bad for British companies like his own. Well, he's in the latest rich list of the Sunday Times. He's listed with £3.5 billion, so it can't have been that bad.
I think there is quite a difference between big business, which by and large looks as though it's in favour of staying in the European Union, and that's entirely predictable. But I think there is a big divide, a much sharper divide, in small business. There are businesses who are very, very pro, who do a lot of trade, who say that it would be very difficult without the single market. And then you get other small businesses who are much more insular and say, oh, it's all the red, you know, you hear all the arguments about red tape, regulations, all those things, which most of us actually regard as generally a good thing. But those particular businesses don't. And I think the divide is actually much sharper in small and medium-sized business than it is actually at the top level.
Because it's fascinating, that thing about, you know, red tape and paperwork, because it's become a catch-all. Any piece of paper in that is now blamed on the EU. Any form you fill, oh, it must be, you know, EU directive that's forced us to do it. Mary, do you think there's something missing here, though, that, you know, and I'd be interested to hear from both of you on this. I wonder whether, you know, it's interesting that none of the debate seems move into the kind of more emotional kind of part of this, you know, is, do you feel European? Do you feel that actually, whether you like it or not, we've changed a bit. You know, we're a part of something a bit bigger. Because when I meet many, you know, young people and from all sorts of backgrounds, you know, how they travel, how they consume food, how they watch movies, TV. You know, we've just watched a German TV show here be one of the biggest hits ever in German on a terrestrial TV station. We've changed. You know, that wouldn't have happened in the past. And I think that when it comes to the vote, Mary, I wonder whether you think we've just changed emotionally. And I think that that's the bit that none of the politicians seem to be able to articulate or kind of get their heads around.
I think it's very early in the campaign, which has hardly started yet, and that that may be, as it were, towards the latter stages of the campaign. I think there's a deliberate effort at the moment to try and persuade people, very much like the Scottish referendum, to look at sort of nuts and bolts and say, you know, these are the figures, these are the facts, this is what you must choose on. I agree with you absolutely that there will be an emotional factor, but I think the problem with the UK is that there's an emotional factor both ways, and that while, you know, probably people under 30, maybe under 40, lived with Europe, take it for granted, and maybe feel European. And, you know, if you go to somewhere like Australia or Canada, I mean, you immediately see bits and pieces of what maybe Britain was like before the European community. You see, it's much more English, or in the case of Canada, English and French speaking. It's not the whole continental aspect of it is practically missing. And so you do recognise when you see that how much we've changed. But I just wonder how much, you know, the actual voters realise that they've changed. And I think there are going to be people who, you know, we're all going to have to go out campaigning and making this point. I was at a debate just before Christmas at Durham University on the side of staying in. And there it was very emotionally charged, and it was practically 50-50. And I'm pleased to say that our side won just on the final vote.
Sebastian, on the German side, do you think the Germans struggle to understand what we're on about? Because, you know, just on this emotional side, you know, when you go to Germany, when you go to any of the, you know, the regions, when you go to especially the south, you know, you have a sense that Germans are very good at being very, very German when they want to be, and being very European when they want to be. They manage to hold on to...
And very Bavarian when they want to be, in my case.
Yeah, anyway, exactly. Yes. You go to Bavaria, you can, you know, you can turn up in your Lederhosen, and you can be on a traditional day and be very, very invested in your culture. But then you can be completely modern and connected in an emotional way to Europe in a different way.
I agree, but of course the history is different, and we shouldn't forget that, I suppose. I mean, Britain still has that, totally understandably, I think, the pride in having stood alone in 1940, and the whole continent was united, wasn't it, more or less anyway, under this rather unpleasant man called Hitler. So... I think the emotional connection is easier for us Germans, Dutch, French, Italians, and also, of course, you have to be fair and say we're not this referendum is not about being in Europe. It's about being part of a political club, and so by all means, I think that's the argument that people for Brexit would make. You know, we can travel and we can be friendly and all that, but we don't want to be part of the club. Yes, you do want to be part of the club. You do want to be part of the club, not least because the club gives you more clout, but the club is also important in the wider world. Someone quite rightly said, the only person who will be applauding Britain leaving the European Union is Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
And that really shouldn't happen.
Well, we're going to cross away from this story now. We're going to go to the US, where you can probably guess what's dominating the news. All eyes are on the state of Nevada today as Republicans vie for the top spot in the fourth state race to win the nomination. But aside from the brash simplicity seeping out of Donald Trump, it's perhaps a bigger test for Marco Rubio. After Jeb Bush ended his campaign at the weekend, Nevada is the first chance for Rubio to convince voters that he's the moderate of choice in this bizarre presidential race. Mary...
I'm not sure that Nevada is actually the place where moderates actually hold sway.
I think it looks like it's going to be a bit of a clean sweep, isn't it? For Rubio is going to is properly going to struggle here.
Yes, I mean, I think that somehow Nevada and Trump almost belong together. So it's quite hard to see how Rubio in particular would do particularly well. I mean, I was just looking at some pictures of the pair of them campaigning in Nevada just before coming here. And the difference between them, I mean, Rubio looks so sort of washed and brushed and so uptight and just so sort of WASP American, which he's actually not, but he would need to look that to campaign for a particular constituency. And Donald Trump is so much everything else. And you just think, well, yes, let's wait until Super Tuesday.
But what is it? The Trump train has gone, you know, it's so far ahead now. You know, yesterday he claimed that he might want to punch somebody who heckled him. You know, there's no kind of comeback now at all. He's completely managed to be able to say exactly what he wants, isn't he?
I thought there was more of a comeback from both Cruz and Rubio in the last few days, but of course now that's been overshadowed by Cruz's spokesman having put out a falsified video. I still can't quite get my head around it. A video which apparently shows Rubio saying the Bible hasn't got many answers or something like that. Where you think, excuse me, I mean, what kind of election is this?
This is when you're really pleased to be European.
Indeed. Isn't that a good point? Yes. Yes, I mean, I'm in the torture chamber here because I've been, for half a year, I've been saying I don't want to talk about Donald Trump, but we do have to, don't we?
It's Mary, just tell me, when the last, you know, if one or two or more of the candidates fall away tomorrow, do we begin to see then a bit of a reshaping of the field? Because actually, if you added up all the numbers, potentially, if everyone who didn't vote for Trump in the last, you know, the last couple of rounds went for the other person who's left standing, whether that is Cruz or whether it's Rubio, they could potentially kind of give him a bit of run for their money. But do we feel that actually many of those people are just going to simply walk across the floor and join Trump as well?
Well, I think probably we have to wait until the 1st of March when there's a much better spread of states, and if the candidates are whittled down like that, and there is, as it were, a united opposition to Trump, then it would be clear, really, how much of a real majority he commands, if he does, among Republicans. So I think we probably have to wait. But I think also, you know, when you do look at it from this side of the Atlantic, it looks sort of extraordinary that somebody like Donald Trump is getting the following he does. But if you look at it from the other side of the Atlantic, then he comes across really as quite an attractive character in the American context. He may not actually be a plausible presidential candidate, but at least through the primaries, you know, he's got a lot going for him. And when he makes mistakes, he can get away with it. He argued with the Pope, for heaven's sake. And then he stood back and he apologised and he got away with both positions.
Well, I think we're going to be coming back to this story quite a lot over the coming weeks. But we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jajewski and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, good news for those fond of the outgoing 500 euro note. Switzerland is going to keep its 1,000-franc one. And why is the Italian Prime Minister sending Europe's elite to an island prison? Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Istanbul, our bureau chief is Christopher Lord.
For us here at Monocle, Turkey has a vital position, not just in the Eastern Balkans, but also looking towards the Middle East, towards Central Asia, and towards these countries that are very, very quickly emerging economically. But Turkey also occupies an extremely important role over the next few years, that's in terms of a kind of economic model, and also in terms of city building, as a model of how you make sure that you're building a society that can continue to evolve and change as that population evolves and changes too.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Wow. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Sebastian Burger and Mary Dzhajewski. For centuries, the name Santo Stefano was enough to strike fear into Italy's nastiest criminals. Dubbed the Italian Alcatraz, the small rocky island between Rome and Naples served as a prison for political rebels, anarchists and anti-fascists. Today, however, it's little more than a crumbling ruin. But if Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has his way, it could soon be housing Europe's leaders of tomorrow. Don't worry, he doesn't actually want to lock them up. Renzi has pledged about 80 million euros to transform the tiny island ruin into a prestigious school and European getaway for the union's future talent. It may sound fairly ambitious for now, but could it prove vital to Matteo Renzi's plan to raise Italy's international influence? Sebastian, it's a funny, quirky story, but it does kind of go to the heart of Matteo Renzi trying to present Italy in a more modern way and put it in a leadership role.
Andrew, I'd like to be one of Europe's future leaders. wouldn't you just love to? I mean, they will turn it into a nice place. You can have spaghetti and vino.
There'll be Aperol spritzes at 5.
It'll be great. The climate is wonderful. It's between Rome and Naples in the Tyrrhenian Sea. Seriously, I mean, I think it's great. It's got all the history that you want. Altiero Spinelli wrote his famous tract there, which was one of the foundation stones of the European Community. I think it's always good to have those kind of retreats where people can meet and talk freely without too many of us around, too many journalists around. And you're quite right. I mean, he's trying to make a serious point. For decades, we've been saying Italy is underrepresented as the fourth largest economy in the union and a founder member and a reliable member. All praise to him, I have to say.
Mary, again, this notion of, you know, bringing people together, we see it happen in the Nordic countries. They're pretty good at kind of setting up these kind of getaway island retreats where you bring together political leaders, especially from the region. You see it in Davos, of course, with these big kind of think tank sessions. But here, you know, he's trying to do something which seems reasonably inspirational and perhaps does something for the Italian brand. Because, you know, Sebastian is saying not only was it underrepresented, but I think when people felt or thought rather about Italian politics, they felt it was a bit corrupt and uninspiring and Machiavellian. And this is a way of and it probably is all of those things in places, but attempting to say, actually, Italy is also quite good at modernity.
Well, I think several things about this. The first is that I think the French...
First is you're going
to
go with Sebastian, aren't you?
Of course. I think the French might have something to say about this because they have one of the sort of elite European business schools, and they probably think that everybody either goes to their own homegrown ENA or they go to INSEAD. And they probably don't think there is any room at all for an Italian elite school for Europeans. I can also imagine that other Europeans would sort of gang up and say, well, why don't you make it for a school for Italian politicians to train them in the ways of the world and the art of doing politics in a sort of honest and uncorrupted way. So I'm not sure how successful he's going to be.
Well,
you're such a cynic.
She obviously went to INSEAD. We're going to move on. Those prone to purchases in the impulse aisle of the supermarket will be pleased to know that the 500 euro banknote is on its way out. However, despite apparently being used almost exclusively by shady crooks, Switzerland... it's not Switzerland, by the way. Don't worry. Switzerland is vowing to continue circulating its 1,000 Swiss franc note. Most Swiss people have probably never handled the large denomination, but there are about 45 million of them trading hands. International police say that large banknotes provide a perfect tool for money laundering. Singapore recently stopped producing its $10,000 note, the largest in the world. But despite international concerns, Switzerland is sticking to its top note. Sebastian, we'll come back to you again. It's interesting because apparently something like 60% of the value of Swiss money in circulation is in these notes. And that globally, everybody is saying it is a way of kind of stashing money and doing dodgy deals.
There's no excuse for it, I think. There's no excuse for it. I mean, the Swiss National Bank spokesman says it remains a useful tool for payment transactions and for storing value. And you think, for heavens, well, of course. I mean, it's a little piece of paper with a certain amount of value. That's true, but that's a totally nonsensical statement. It reminded me, you know, I was a crime reporter in Munich. It reminded me of the German government in 1990, interestingly, in all the upheaval about reunification, changing the 1,000 Deutschmark note. Because we had a kidnapping in Munich in the 70s, and the guy who had been sent to jail for 15 years was about to come out, and he had extracted 21 million Deutschmarks in used 1,000 mark notes from the family of this poor man, and so the note was changed, the bill, the 1,000 Deutschmark bill was changed just to not let him get away with digging up the money that he'd hidden away somewhere. It's a tool for crooks and shouldn't exist.
Mary, we are seeing a big shift to, you know, digital payments, and many police forces are encouraging this idea that we shouldn't really be carrying around banknotes. You know, even the tax authorities don't like it because it's a way of kind of dodging paying tax. Do you have any sympathy with the Swiss?
I have absolutely no sympathy with them at all. I agree absolutely with Sebastian. I think that the Brits are incredibly suspicious of big notes. And I mean, even if you take a £50 note into a shop, you practically have to get it cleared by a layer of three hierarchies.
Well, the Brits are, of course, the other extreme. They pay for a croissant and a coffee with their silly credit card and hold up the traffic. I'm seething in the aisles every other day.
Now, finally this evening, as loyal Monocle readers will know, there are few things that we enjoy more than travelling the world and putting together a carefully curated list of which cities we think are the best in the world. Well, cities such as Tokyo, Copenhagen and Melbourne always rank highly, but unsurprisingly, the Austrian capital also scores very nicely indeed. Our most recent survey, back in August, put the city in second spot, and now another survey seems to agree. The 18th Mercer Quality of Life survey has put Vienna in the top spot. Now, what's Vienna doing right? Mary?
I've got a special interest in this because we were talking about what difference being in the European Union had made. And I think Austria has been one of the biggest beneficiaries. I spent a summer in Vienna when I was a student, long time ago. Still the Cold War, Vienna was out on a complete limb. It was agonising. I hated it. The whole place was on edge. It was very conservative. You had to take off your shoes before you went into somebody's flat. There were twee little concerts in the open air that everybody sat very properly at. I absolutely hated it. I've been back several times in the last 5 years, and it is fabulous. From the new airport to the redoing of the downtown to the restorations, the whole thing is absolutely top quality, fantastic.
Are you a Vienna fan?
Well, it has a great newspaper, of course, Der Standard, who has an excellent London correspondent. I like Vienna very much. I mean, I think it's a great place to be. Munich, where I come from, is scoring pretty well as well.
You're talking about Vienna. Don't try and move the story across the border. Oh, well, let's just stick with the story for now.
No, I mean, I'm always interested in those surveys. And for me, what makes a city great to live in is I can walk around to a lot of places in the center of the city. I have a great transport system. I have comparatively good air. And I can get away quickly to some nature and get away from the big city. And obviously, that's all of those Vienna has. apart from great history, wonderful music, museums, which are really second to none. So, I mean, yeah, I fully subscribe.
And just that great sense, you know, that here was a city that was once the capital city of an empire of like 50-odd million people. Then it found itself the capital city of like 5 million people, and it's only got 2 million people in it now. So it always feels it's so overblown and so full up with these extraordinary buildings for the size of the population.
I mean, we cheekily call it the gateway to the Balkans, of course. Yes. and it is true that there is a lingering sense of the connection to the former parts of the empire, to Croatia, Slovenia, but also to Hungary and parts of Ukraine and all that.
But no, 40 years ago, you felt you were, as it were, in Central Europe, but on the very edge, on a very dangerous edge. And now you feel that you're on the edge or in the borderlands, but in the best possible way.
Well, if you want to go to Vienna, I suggest you join us for the Monocle Quality of Life Conference, because that's happening in Vienna. So you can go to monocle.com to find out about that. But for now, that's all we have. My special thanks to my guests, Sebastian Borger and Mary Jajewski. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Yasmin Omar, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Our international playlist continues next. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's goodbye.